Welcome back. Over the last few lectures, I've been talking about the development of urbanism and urban civilization over a vast area of South Asia in the 3rd millennium BC, the civilization that we call the Harappan civilization. And I noted a whole variety of different challenges that Harappan civilization poses for archaeologists in the characteristics of its towns and cities, in the relative absence of evidence for vast degrees of social and political hierarchy, in the issues it raises about governance in societies that seem to work in very different ways than the prototypical early states that we've already seen in the Nile Valley and in Mesopotamia. And finally, just the scale of Harappan civilization, which is significantly greater in many ways than in those other cases. We're now going to shift our attentions further to the east to look at the development of cities and states and civilization in central China, an area where we're confronted with similar issues of scale and probably similar sizes of territories as we saw in the Indus Valley. Westerners have been fascinated by Chinese civilization for centuries, but this has not necessarily been an advantage for archaeologists trying to understand the origins of Chinese civilization. Europeans have often conceived of Chinese high culture as a culture of the pen and paid particular attention to the development of writing systems, the appearance of a literate class, and literary achievements in high culture and politics, and especially to the development, the appearance of the classics of Chinese literature. We've often tended in the West to view Chinese society as formed by classics, represented by classics, written by a few philosopher sages, most famously Confucius, Confucius, and Lao Tzu, with Confucian, Neo-Buddhist, and Taoist canons gradually accreting through time as essentially literary structures, programs for talking about how the world should work, which they certainly did. The question is, did the world actually work in the way that these Chinese classics said that it should? There's also been a dependence on historical texts, like Sima Jian's extraordinary Shijie, the records of the grand historian written about 100 BC, and examining the history of China into legendary times more than a millennium before that. And there's no doubt that these historical texts are extraordinary feats of human diligence and human imagination, and that they're extraordinarily valuable ways of understanding the development of Chinese civilization. No doubt about this at all. There is, however, a danger here. Looking at China only as a land populated by sages propounding the timeless mysteries of the East exoticizes and trivializes Chinese culture. Moreover, this concentration on written records really doesn't get us back to the origin of things, to the beginnings of Chinese civilization, when writing was only being invented, and even before that, to understand the processes by which urbanism, states, and literacy first appeared. In other words, the aims of this series of lectures. The situation in China, as we think about understanding the Chinese past, often appears similar to me to that I've already spoken about in Egypt, where for a long time, and for similar reasons, going back to the Greeks, historical sources were privileged over archaeological ones. Well, what then do we know about the archaeological background to state formation and civilization in prehistoric China? One thing that needs to be noted at the outset is that for the first time in this course, we've now stepped beyond the bounds of the West Asian agricultural system, the one that has been the foundation of states and civilizations in every case that we've looked at to this point, with its primary domesticates, its primary cereal domesticates, wheat and barley, as well as domesticated cattle, sheep, and goats. The Indus Valley, and thus the Harappan civilization, is on the edge of that zone, as I've already noted. But in China, different cereals, especially, were domesticated. And the reason that this is significant for archaeologists, of course, is that these are actually different plants. What that means is that the processes of domestication, the timing of domestication, the productivity of early forms of cereal crops varies from place to place. The environments, the needs of different plants, different cereals, is in fact different in different areas. So that as we switch from one environmental zone and one agricultural zone to another, we have to recalibrate our expectations about the appearance and development of agricultural systems. And when we do that, that affects the way we understand prehistory and cultural development more generally. So what crops are we talking about in East Asia and China? First and most famously, of course, rice. Today, one of the most important cereal crops in the world, arguably the most important domesticated plant on the planet. But also, for example, a crop, another cereal called foxtail millet, which is not the same as African millet, but also an ancient cereal domesticate in North China. So these are the cereals that are going to affect the way that we think about cultural development, economic development, and civilization in China. It seems that forager populations in modern China were probably gathering wild rice during the early Holocene by perhaps as much as 12,000 years ago. Domestication of rice probably occurred close to the border of South China, Vietnam, and Laos, the area where those wild grasses, most closely related morphologically and genetically to domesticated rice, are found today. By about 6,000 BC, small rice farming communities existed through much of central and southern China, at sites like Heimudu or the Majiabang sites near modern Shanghai, and at Daji in the Three Gorges area of the middle Yangtze River Valley. For the most part, these sites are in fairly wet lake and riverside environments where rice could be grown, this is important, without irrigation. I've talked about the importance of irrigation in other parts of the old world, and we'll be talking about it again. These areas include substantial villages with evidence for interregional trade, but nothing that suggests any important degree of social difference within or between communities. There's also a wide distribution of related forms of cord-marked pottery, along the coasts of South China and on Hainan and Taiwan offshore. This probably indicates coastal trade and a fairly sophisticated nautical technology along this part of the Chinese coast as well, among farming populations along this part of the Chinese coast. And some archaeologists relate this pottery distribution with the initial expansion of a language family called Austronesian, which is now one of the most widespread language families on Earth, with people speaking Austronesian languages spread from Polynesia, from Hawaii and Eastern Island, in the east to Madagascar. Further to the north, and at about the same time, farming communities concentrated on growing foxtail millet in and around the valley of the Huanghe River. This Yang Shao culture, as it's called, is better known than are the equivalent rice-growing sites and traditions to the south, and flourished between approximately 5,000 and 3,000 BC. At sites like Banpo and Jiangshai, people lived in groups of perhaps 300 to 500 people, occupying clusters of dwellings distributed around large buildings that may have served as communal houses. On some of these sites, these Yangshao sites, houses and cemeteries are found together in distinct spatial clusters. That is, you'll get a cluster of houses with an associated cemetery or set of cemeteries. This may indicate that these communities were organized into corporate groups, probably on a kinship basis, that is, groups of related people within a lineage or a clan, and that these people lived together and were buried together as well. As further to the south, there is no evidence for wealth or status differences between households within Yangshao communities. However, it's interesting to note that Yangshao sites are usually surrounded by defensive ditches and sometimes by palisades, which suggests the conflict between communities was a danger at this time. This is a period where we're seeing substantial population growth in these areas, a multiplication of settlements. Perhaps we are seeing some degree of pressure on agricultural resources in this Yangshao territory, in this area where the Yangshao culture is found. So it's possible that what we're seeing here is human response to resource pressure that manifests itself in conflicts between different groups. Houses on these Yangshao sites seem to have been rebuilt repeatedly. Now, there's a number of ways of thinking about this, what that implies. And archaeologists have often suggested that what this means is that Yangshao populations practiced a particular form of agriculture that we're going to encounter, especially in parts of the New World, in Mesoamerica. This form of agriculture is called Swidden agriculture, or more picturesquely, slash and burn agriculture. And that this form of agriculture is what forced Yangshao populations to relocate their villages frequently. So you could imagine a circumstance in which people would be repeatedly moving their communities from place to place and potentially then moving back to locations that they had vacated earlier and rebuilding houses. What does Swidden agriculture involve? Swidden agriculture is a practice that's often used in forested environments It's frequently thought of as a mode of initial colonization of forests by farmers, although in many parts of the world it continues to be used today. It involves clearing land to the extent possible of trees. And we have to realize now, for early farming populations, for early agricultural populations, that would be a real challenge. There's no chainsaws, not even metal axes. This would involve cutting trees down with stone axes. So, to the extent possible, trees would be cut. And then the cleared area, or at least the semi-cleared area, because there probably would be vegetation still left standing, trees and brush would be burned off to fertilize the soil. So initial clearance, then burning of the area, burning of the fields in order to fertilize the soil. And then these fields would be farmed for a number of years. After a few years, soil fertility usually declines again, and the cycle is repeated elsewhere. And there's often a longer-term cycle where a particular family will have some fields that are fully in use, they're clearing other areas, and they're leaving other areas fallow after they've been exploited. So the cycle is repeated in different places. Unsurprisingly, given this rather extensive agricultural system, Sweden agriculture, slash-and-burn agriculture, is often associated with settlement mobility and relatively low population densities. So one explanation for this repeated rebuilding of houses on Yang Shao sites is the sort of mobility associated with Sweden agriculture. However, as we saw, for example, at Çatalhöyük in Turkey, houses can be rebuilt, they may well be rebuilt, even without settlement relocation. And rebuilding of houses in and of itself is probably not proof that settlement movement, settlement relocation happened. If we want to think of analogies to these Chinese Yang Shao communities, these early agricultural communities in central China, the best analogy in areas that we've already looked at would be the Hsunan culture, relatively egalitarian farming populations of northern Mesopotamia that, as I noted, we've already examined. These northern Yang Shao villages in the same area were succeeded by a very, very important culture called Longshan. And Longshan culture sites date to between about 2900 and 1900 BC, and they share some characteristics with earlier Yang Shao cultural traditions in the same area. So there seems to be a cultural development from Yang Shao to Longshan, with some pretty significant innovations as well. For example, there's good evidence for substantial economic changes in Longshan times. Through the Longshan period, for example, rice seems increasingly to supplement millet as an important cereal crop. As I noted, this can be quite significant throughout the economy, and it can affect settlement systems, potential for social hierarchy, and so on. We have to think about the potential increase in productivity associated with rice farming vis-a-vis agriculture that's based only on millet. At the same time, wheat and cattle are introduced into local economies. That's interesting. These new crops may have allowed increased population densities and site growth continuing after the Yang Shao period, and probably did particularly well on the rich alluvial soils along the Huang Ho River. I will note, you may have caught this to this point, both wheat and cattle would have originally been imported to what is now China from West Asia. This might have happened via the farming communities around the Indus Valley, but the exact route of introduction of especially wheat, but also cattle, is at this point unknown. Longshan occupations tend to be much larger and internally more complex than were earlier Yangshao sites. A number of these sites measured between 50 and 75 acres in size. That's a substantial settlement area. One such Longshan site, Daozi, was as large as 750 acres in late Longshan times, although the population density over that area was probably quite uneven. It's not as if at Daozi there was a high settlement population over this entire very large area of 750 acres. Such sites could probably have accommodated at least population numbers in the low thousands. So by late Longshan times, we're getting evidence for some pretty substantial population aggregates in central China. In a number of areas, there's evidence of three-level regional site hierarchies, settlement hierarchies, with larger Longshan centers surrounded by smaller villages and hamlets. The central sites, these large central sites, are in a number of cases surrounded by pounded earth ramparts, and this is a form of production of platforms and defensive walls that will be extensively used in China in later times, with essentially courses of earth pounded into place and then succeeded by later courses as walls and ramparts and platforms build up. This indicates an increasing need for defense against external attack during Longshan times. As I noted, even Yangshao communities seem to be defended in a number of cases. Certain Longshan burials during this period between 2900 and 1900 BC are accompanied by rich grave goods. Not all of them, but some of them by rich grave goods, especially fine ceramics and artifacts made of exotic material like jade, which would be, again, ideologically and culturally important in later times in China as well. These rich grave goods seem to signal the status of the individual being buried. Some Longshan houses are much larger than others and are built on top of, again, pounded earth platforms, built up above the rest of the community. Again, signaling status and wealth. So powerful people, rich people, would be able to literally sit in their houses and look down from these artificial platforms at the rest of the community. At the same time, cemeteries of the Daowenko culture, which are found closer to the Chinese coast in Shandong, similarly show that some individuals were being buried with richer grave goods than are others. Some of these Daowenko burials also show evidence of being accompanied by communal feasting as a way of ushering this person into death. So this may be part of a more general regional development of social hierarchy and wealth in Longshan times. Longshan potters produced a very distinctive, very beautiful, fine, polished blackware that eventually is found far beyond the Huanghe River Valley, as far away as South China, and is often associated with elite burials through all of the regions where it's found. The analogy here, if we wanted to use an analogy to an area that we've already looked at, might be to Halafian elite pottery. That tradition succeeding the Hassunan agricultural tradition in northern Mesopotamia, where we again saw a distribution of very fine, in that case very highly decorated, elite pottery over substantial areas. Archaeologists sometimes speak about a Longshan cultural sphere or a Longshanoid tradition over a substantial area of China. This would be an elite tradition of ceremony, of spectacle, of feasting and burial. First developed in Longshan communities, and then adopted by elites again in different parts of China. This is an interesting idea, but it raises two separate but related questions. The first is, what was the social and political organization found on Longshan sites? There is, as we've seen, evidence for large populations occupying complex settlement systems, for distinct and quite important differences in wealth and power within at least central communities in these settlement hierarchies, and for warfare between communities. Most archaeologists would, yet again, identify these Longshan political units as chiefdoms and not yet states, in part because of the lack of evidence for bureaucratic institutions expressed, for example, through writing and literacy that we'll see in later periods. In this formulation, the leaders of these chiefdoms, the chiefs, will be some of the people inhabiting larger houses on platforms in Longshan population centers. However, late Longshan chiefdoms would be somewhat complex examples of this political form. They would have been based on local centers and controlled relatively small areas, but at the same time, status differences in Longshan communities were quite marked, and Longshan leaders seem to have cultivated ties with other elite groups over fairly large areas. As we'll see in the next lecture, it's the end of Longshan times and the beginning of the Xia period, named after a semi-legendary dynasty in Chinese history that the transition to the first Chinese states probably took place, so right at the end of the Longshan. The second question, what was the influence of Longshan culture on other areas of China? Longshan pottery is certainly widespread, and some aspects of Longshan material culture are spread from its origins in the central Huanghe River Valley to areas in Shandong and the Yangtze River Valley. However, one unfortunate tendency in Chinese archaeology has been to spend too much time examining the prehistory of these very important regions while tending to ignore areas of southern, western, and northern China, which were often assumed to be peripheral to important cultural developments. It's likely that cultural and political processes parallel to those along the Huanghe and Yangtze rivers were taking place in other parts of China at the same time, especially in the south. However, we do not as yet have a picture of culture history in these regions comparable to that in the Yangtze and Huanghe River valleys. So, in my next lecture, I'll talk about the continuation of these processes of increasing political and social hierarchy, and their culmination in the appearance of the first real undoubted states in China, and particularly the Shang state. Thank you.